my name is Marie Saffo. Hi. And I'm a really grateful recovered alcoholic addict. So my sobriety date is October 2nd, 2001. By the grace of God, this program, some hard work, and a lot of surrender, I haven't had a drink since then. And so I know that a lot of the time when we tell our story, we spend a whole bunch of time in the what it used to be like. I am less and less interested in that part of my life, and I'm more and more interested in what happened. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time telling you what landed me in AR, but I'm going to really fast forward through a lot of the glorification, because what happened in AR is really what changed my life. And for me to be able to work here and to help you guys maybe find what I found here is just, it's the reason I did all the crap that I did. So somewhere when I was 14 years old, in 68, I fell in love. And I fell in love when I had my first drink. And I don't know how many of you guys actually remember your first drink or your first drugs. Anybody here remembers the first time? Look at those hands. You're part of my tribe. I remember it because I remember where I was, who I was with, what happened, what I felt, and for the first time, I fit in. I fit in my skin, I fit in my life, I figured out how to be social, I figured out how to get along with people, and so I just started drinking. Nothing wrong with it, right? Everybody was doing it. So fast forward through the years of drinking on the weekend, same story for everybody. Drinking increases, right? What I did not know then, and I know now, is that underneath the drinking was a severe, severe codependence. They used to call that love. And then they made up this new word. And so for about the next 8 years, my drinking increased, but everything was in control, right? So not an issue. And then I started discovering other stuff. That was the early 70s. It was a seducing time. We were told that using drugs was good. We were told that you could take a drug, tune in, turn on, and drop out. I don't know if somebody has heard those words, but that was kind of the philosophy in those days, that you sought enlightenment through drugs. Through LSD, through psychedelics, through all kinds of stuff like that. So I had many spiritual experiences on drugs. Many. But nothing changed in my life. I had all of these moments of awakening, touching God, blah, 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 and then I would go back down here and do the same damn thing all the time. I wanted to stay there. I didn't want to come back down here and apply any of the stuff that I had figured out through these altered states. So in those days, I was living in England. I was going to school, going through college. Alcohol, drugs increased, but everybody is doing it. So it wasn't a problem. It was not a problem. It was just a way of life, right? So denial. It started becoming a problem when I had this plan that sounded really good at the time to start dealing heroin so I could make enough money really fast to go to spend 2 years in India to study Buddhism. Great plan, right? What could possibly go wrong? So I had never touched heroin. I had no intention of touching it because I had heard bad stuff about it. I was scared. It was just a business transaction, just a business deal. So that was, I had returned to Switzerland. I was teaching. I was a high school teacher in a boarding school, American boarding school, teaching French and English. And I was dealing heroin on the side. I was actually the courier. That's the part of my story that my son told me you should write a book, because I literally would don a wig and have my mom's borrow my mom's mink coat and get on a train with a suitcase and just do the exchanges in railway stations in Switzerland. Still hadn't touched the stuff. And then one evening we had a big party and this joint was going around and I started smoking this joint, and damn, that was the best weed I'd ever had in my life. You know the rest of the story, right? Yeah. So, somebody had laced the joint with heroin, and I got hooked. The first time, I got hooked. I drank a lot less, but I started dabbling with the drugs. So the heroin, that just did a number. So I'm not going to go into the details. I detoxed cold turkey twice, and I still remember 30 years later what those weeks were like. And then I decided I'm never doing that again. I came to the United States, came here for 30 days to visit an old boyfriend, and I never left. I came in 1981 for 1 month to detox from heroin, to visit an old boyfriend, and I never left. So obviously my life was not following a linear path, right? I was doing things just because the wind was blowing with way and the wind was blowing that way. So I came here and I detoxed and I was very, very sick. Could not find heroin in El Paso at the time, but guess what there was here? There was a lot of pot. There was a lot of meth too. So there was a lot of crack. So over the next few years, I would drink, I would do drugs, I stopped doing drugs, I stopped drinking when I had my son. I tried to straighten up, did good for a while, and then in my 40s, all hell broke loose. And all the issues I hadn't dealt with just came home to roost. I became very, very depressed. My drug use increased. I played in a band. I had a double life. I had a child development center at the time. So imagine that, right? Complete double life. Playing in a band on a weekend, lying to people, lying to my son, lying to all my friends. My family didn't know. You know that story too. So it takes a while. It takes a lot of energy to keep the parts of my life separate, because my family cannot know this, and my non-using friends cannot know this, and you know how that works. And so all the time I was losing myself. I was completely losing myself. I don't remember 2000. I don't remember what happened. I remember New Year's Eve. And I remember, because we were with my son in Switzerland, it was the big deal, right, from 1999 to 2000. And I still have regrets about that. He doesn't, but I have regrets about that, that I, you know, we smoked pot together and we drank together, and he was 16. And so I gave him the impression that this was okay, and I was the cool mom. I was just a cool mom, and that's what I did, so I thought that was okay. 2000, I went downhill. I went downhill really fast. Major depression, not going to work, hiding, isolating. I think for the last 18 months before I came to AR, I hardly got out of the house. I would go out to pick up my son from school. Sometimes I wouldn't pick him up because I was passed out. I was doing crack at that time. So my life was going downhill. Early 2001, this is when everything broke out. So one of the things that I had done that I had still not proud of it to this day, but I made amends, is that I had a 10-year relationship with a married guy. So that created a lot of problem in my psyche, because it's not who I am, number one, and so I was making sure that I would never get the love I was seeking, right? What better way to set this up? So I became a recluse. This is when suicide became an option. I did not know how to stop using drugs, but I didn't know how to live. I wanted to stop, and I didn't know how. Have you felt that when you want to stop and you can't? When the drugs don't work anymore? When you can't get high? That's a sucky place. And so in February 2001, there was one evening, my son was out. And there was an evening when I went out of my mind. And there was an evening when I decided that this was the evening that I would end everything. So I had enough stuff, I had enough pills, I had enough stuff, I had lined the pills on the table. I had the booze, I had everything, I had written the letter. My mind was so messed up that I thought, somehow, in my twisted mind, I thought I would do my son a favor because I was screwing up his life. And I had this German Shepherd that I had rescued, that had actually found us. And she came and she sat and she stared me down. And something broke through. And at that moment, I thought, hold on. I can't. She's not going to understand. She's going to be right here, and I'm going to die next to her. What's going to happen? How can I do that? Something broke through, right? Something broke through. And instead of taking the pills, I called the suicide hotline. And I could hardly talk. I was just bawling and bawling and bawling. And it was a Saturday night. And they told me, are you okay for the weekend? And I said, yeah. Come on Monday morning. So I went to MHMR February 2001. Long story short, they were going to test me for drugs. So I quit all the drugs. Guess what happened to the alcohol use? Jacked up. They were not testing me from alcohol. Between February and October 2001, I became a full-blown alcoholic. As soon as I couldn't do the drugs, the alcohol took over. And so I look at alcohol as the bookends of my life. It kicked my ass. I was able to put down the drugs. I could not put down alcohol. I'll be damned. And I still didn't think I was an alcoholic. I just thought I was depressed, right? So I come to AR. I found all kinds of excuses to not show up, right? February to October. Every month there was an excuse. Every month there was something. And then finally 9/11 happened. So I'm home. I'm drunk from morning to night. I'm watching TV. And this stuff that's real is happening in the world. And that just broke through my fog. And I thought, damn, some people have real problems. There's real stuff going on. And here I am just all day long feeling sorry for myself. So something broke through it that day, too. And so I called AR. And there was a real person that answered the phone. Her name was Frances Hoy. I'll never forget. Because I had called a lot of places. I didn't have any money to pay for treatment. Called a lot of places. And she heard something in my voice, and she says, hold on. She said, just call every day until we get a bed. And I called every day till we got a bed. I hear some of you tell me that story, too. I hear some of you tell me that. But while I called every day to get a bed, I sure didn't get sober. I knew I was coming to rehab, so what happened? Yeah. You know, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. One last run, right, till the last day. So October 1st was the last day that I drank. And I was supposed to drive to Austin that afternoon. That never happened. Supposed to drive to Austin that night. That never happened. So I had to get my ass out of bed at 5 o'clock. It was a Tuesday, October 2nd, 2001. And I drove from Temple to Austin, going to rehab, scared to death, hungover like hell. Didn't know what I was doing, but something in my psyche knew that something would change in a drastic way. And I felt intense fear. And I got to just about Round Rock. And something happened that morning that I had never seen before. There was a sunrise and there was a moonset at the same time on both sides of the road. And I watched that, and something in me said, I just kind of knew I was going to be okay. I didn't know how, but I kind of knew I was going to be okay. So I get to rehab. Everything is cool. I had a blast in detox. Austin Recovery had their own detox then. I had been isolated for, I don't know, a year and a half. I had hidden my disease. I was so ashamed of what I was doing. And here I am in detox, and I can talk freely. And people like me. And I can say, my name is Maryse. I'm an alcoholic addict. Yeah, come on here. Hi, how are you? Something just left me. But then being codependent, I also fell in love in detox, you know, with another junkie. Thank God separated us at the time. The women were in treatment at Trust Park, and the guys were at the ranch. I would totally have been one of those clients that had slipped notes to everybody. I know that about myself. I just know that about myself. So that was a good thing. I have props. And in detox, they talk about this book. And our director at the time was called Bill Wigmore. And they talked about Bill W. I just assumed they were one and the same. Took me a whole minute to figure out the difference. And when they talked about Bill's story, I figured I better read that story just to know what everybody else is talking about so I can sound smart like everybody else. So I skipped the preamble, the edition. I skipped all of that, right? I just want to be able to talk, to gossip, to yap. So I read Bill's story, blah, 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 blah. This is my second book, by the way. My first book completely fell apart. But I didn't. So I read this book, and I get to page 8, and it's a Sunday morning, and I'm in detox, and I'm out there smoking, and by some reason, I'm alone. There's nobody smoking around me, which you know is a miracle. So I'm alone. There's nobody talking, and I pick up the book, and I get to that paragraph on page 8, and it says, "No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. Alcohol was my master. And something broke. Years and walls of denial broke. I fell on my knees in the grass. I cried like a baby, and I had my hands up, and I asked a God I didn't even really believe in at the time to help me. I didn't know about surrender. I didn't know about the steps. I didn't know that that's what I had done. I just know that I could not go on anymore. And at that moment, I felt something I've never felt before or since. I felt a sense of love. I felt something was going to be okay. I felt love from God. That's all I can explain. And I got up, and I walked back in detox, and I remember there was a guy called Michael Peck. Yeah, you all know Michael Peck. So he was a tech. He was an RCS, and he was working in detox, and I was a mess. I had been crying, but I walked back in and I said, "He took me back. He took me back." And I had had a spiritual experience. And what I know now of spiritual experience is that they come when you are at your wits' ends. They come when there's nothing that you can hold on to anymore. They come when the ego finally gives up trying to do it on its own. So that became the beginning of my road at AR. So this is a journal, right? We tell you guys and we tell women to journal, right? Let me tell you why you should journal. Not because we tell you to. Because when you journal what happens in rehab, you have a captain's log. 16 years later, 16 years later, I open this up today to refresh my memory and to remind my heart what happened at Austin Recovery. And we had an awakening in the morning, and they told us, bring your book, bring your journal, and just write to God. If you don't believe in God, write to a spirit, write to Great Spirit. So I couldn't say the word God, so I would write to Big Daddy. That was bigger than me. And it had none of this religious connotation that I had a hard time too, you know. I was a mystical child. I had went to Catholic school, and I was very disillusioned. So it was, even though I had felt the experience of the presence of God, I couldn't say the word God because of the connotation that I had as a child. I can now. So every morning, I would write to God in my journal, and now I can take this 13 years later, and I can write what I wrote. And there is some things in here. I got a calling at Austin Recovery. I got a calling to help others. I got a calling to make something of my life and use all the, how many children are there? Well, okay, no cussing. Okay. I got a calling to use all the crap, and I use that as a clinical term, using all the crap of my life to make fertilizer. Some of you that come to my classes know I use that metaphor a lot. That's the only thing you can do. When your life becomes a big pile of manure, that's the only thing you can do. You use that to make fertilizer, to plant a new garden for others. And that's what service work is. Yeah? That's what service is. And so I was begging God. So this is an example. Monday, October 15, 2001. Thank you for all my friends, my wonderful son especially. The first Monday of a full week, I trust you will send me exactly what I need to learn, even though I may not know it or agree with it. The damn rules. Getting up at 6. Having to go and eat breakfast when I don't eat breakfast. But I don't eat breakfast. You have to go to the cafeteria. But I don't eat breakfast. You have to go to the cafeteria. Acceptance. Damn, that one was hard. I share a story with the clients I teach. We had suggestion box, right? And we had community. So I could tell everything that was wrong with AR. You know. You live here. You see it. So I stuffed the suggestion box thinking I'm doing my duty. I'm helping AR being a better place. And my counselor starts recognizing my handwriting. And so one day she calls me in her office, and she has all of the little pieces of paper that I had put on her desk. And I'm thinking, I'm going to get praised. This is what she does. She bangs her head on the table. She shows me the piece. She says, what the hell do you think you're doing? That was my first clue. She wasn't that pleased. And I said, well, this is the stuff that's not working. She said, Maurice, you're here for 28 days. AR has been here since 1967. You cannot live your own life. Worry about changing you, not changing AR. Light bulb. Light bulb. Because all of that energy that I was spending focusing on what was not working at AR, all of the dysfunction, all of the stuff, getting caught up in people's stories, all of that was distracting me from doing my work. And so when I noticed that, that's when I let go of that. That's when I made a conscious decision to surrender and to follow frigging rules. That seems like something little. It was huge for me. It was a surrender. That is how I surrendered. Not in my head, by action. And if I couldn't surrender to AR for 28 days, if I wasn't willing to go to any length while I was here, what chance did I have when I left? If I didn't practice the principle while I was here, I couldn't wait until I get out. I was too scared. I was too scared. So something shifted in a great way for me while I was here. And I have found something since then. I have a little book. But this book I've read and read and read. And this book has given me a way to live my life. What I have learned is that when we talk about principles, blah, 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 principles, right? Do you know what they are? Practice these principles in all our affairs. That is what gave me a way to know how to live my life. Honesty, acceptance, surrender, first step principle. Second step principle, hope. Hope. Third step, faith. Do I believe this program is going to work? I don't know, really, but I see that it worked in others, right? So why not me? And I didn't make it on the shallow end of drugs. I am not going to make it on the shallow end of recovery. I had to go to the deep end. I had to go to the deep end of recovery. Some of the things that happened when I got home, my son is in the audience tonight, too. Instead of spending time at home, I was at meetings all the time. I was at meetings at noon. I was at meetings sometimes at 5:30 and some meetings at 8 o'clock at night. I took him to a meeting with me so he could see, why do you have to go to meetings all the time? I showed him what a meeting was. It was raw. It was honest. It was authentic. It was deep. There's spirit in those meetings. There's authenticity in the meeting that we attend. Courage. Fourth step, courage. So much shit happened in sobriety. It has not been a piece of cake. I got fired from a job. I got my bank account frozen by the IRS. I got breast cancer. I lost my brother to cancer. And all that, I lost my dog who saved my life. But I was present for all of it. I was present for all of it. And I realized after I lost Nibbles that there's something about pain that I can embrace today. There's something about pain that I can go into rather than resist. And there's something about pain that I can explore. There's a darkness to pain if I am with it instead of resisting it. I don't know, try it sometimes. A lot of our issues is because we resist pain. Embrace it. See what happens. You get through it. I never knew that. I always tried to go around, to numb, right? There's a way through pain. There's a way through. The rest of the principles, I love integrity, willingness, humility. Hello. That's hard, right? A lot of us are entitled. Addict alcoholics, entitled. Yeah. It always makes me laugh when, I did the same thing, right? I did the same thing. I'm begging, begging, begging to come in, begging AR, calling every day, waiting 3 weeks, and I come in and I'm here for a week and a half and I bitch about the food. Or the pillow, or the bed. Ooh, the beds. That was a great factor in me not relapsing, y'all. I didn't want to come back and have to sleep at AR. I love to work here. I don't want to sleep here. The rest of the principles, love, justice, perseverance, the 10th step, perseverance. Stick with it. Stick with it. Yes, it's hard. But if you don't pick up that day, you get another chance the next day. Stick with it. It gets better. I hear you guys laugh. I hear people laugh. I hear people laugh here with this great, hearty, bubbly laughter that's so genuine. And I know that's the thing that we had lost. I laughed so hard in rehab, and I cried so hard in rehab because I felt everything again. Don't be scared to feel. Don't be scared to feel. It's your way through. What is my bumper sticker trademark thing I'm going to do? You can't heal what you can't feel. You know that it's true, right? You know that it's true. And the last three steps are maintenance step, perseverance, spirituality, and service. So if you're here tonight and you're not a client, you're doing service work just by being here. You're showing the client that I hear that it does work. You're coming back home. And this is hallowed ground for a lot of us. This place almost closed down so many times. And something happens every single time to save it. Because we're the only place that takes everybody. Right? We take everybody. There's one more thing I want to read you. And then I'm going to ask you to do something too. I didn't ask Chris permission, but I'm sure it's okay. I'm writing to, there was a guy that was here about three years ago, I think. His name was Chris Navarro, and he's doing time. He was here for 3 months, and he got sober very hard, but the wreckage of his past caught up with him. He's still sober. He's in jail. I get letters. They're getting more and more desperate. He needs support from alumni. He's an alumni, so with permission, I'm going to put his address on the board, and he doesn't know I'm doing that, but I'm going to ask some of you guys to please write him, tell him you're an AR alumni, and just give him support. Just receiving mail while you're in jail. He's about to go to the big house for 3 years, and he's just finished too, so, and he's still keeping the faith, and he still talks about his time as Austin Recovery as the best time of his life. I know. Those of you that bitch about being here, remember that. There is a step down. There is a worse place. Yeah? And these letters go right to my heart. So there's something I understood, and then I'm going to stop. There's something I understood. What happened at Austin Recovery for me, I understood that when I pray, it cannot be passive. And I'm going to read you something from this tiny little book called Becoming a Practical Mystic, one of my favorite books. Look how small it is. I can carry it in my pocket. And to me, this echoes what Bill said in the big book. Our heads are in the cloud, but our feet have to be on the ground, right? That's the part I never had. I'm fine with the clouds. I love it up there. It's the feet on the ground that I didn't know how to do. And so this little part here says, instead of prayer, I like the word invocation. Invocation is active prayer, co-creative prayer. It is a self-assertive will-to-action prayer that lacks passive religious connotations. In other words, pray, petition, invoke, like you used to do your drug of choice. With that intensity, with that power, with that desire, find that place inside. In the past, we have prayed, but this was an emotional appeal, not frothy, but an emotional appeal, more of a plea of helplessness, that God come into our lives and do both his part and our part for that moment. After that, it is my job to do my part. But I could not stop myself from wanting to use and drink. So God had to do for me what I couldn't do for myself. The rest of my life, since I've left Austin Recovery, my favorite word is synchronicity, because so many things happened I could not have planned. When I got the calling to help others, I had no clue how it was going to work out. I'm 47 years old. I'm broke. How am I going to be a counselor, right? I don't know. So I got a grant, I went to school, it just happened one day at a time, I found an internship, I got hired at the same place, where I got clean and sober. And then I got to do Musical Journey, which is breath work, which is my 11-step process. For me, that is how I transcend reality now, not through alcohol, but through music and breath. The great reality is within. Look within yourself. The healer is within you already. Spirituality is not a treatment outcome. It's the essence of who you are. We just have to clear the crap that stops us from knowing that, right? It's not something you get. It's something you already are. You're a human. You're a spiritual being having a human experience. My plan, God willing, is to continue to do this work at this place in Bungalow 1 for as long as AR will have me. So I'm going to retire here, and then after I'm retired, I'm probably going to come and sponsor some of you guys and just hang out here because you are my tribe, and this is my home. Thank you all.